Nina, yours is an extraordinary story, and one which has seen you come through immense trials and tribulations, and demonstrated, I think, what a determined person and musician you must be. But let's go back to the beginning, Montreal, Canada, where you were born.
Right.
What were your first encounters with the piano?
I had a very ambitious mother, a very wonderful mother. She was very determined, more determined than I am, and studied the piano at École Normale in Paris. And then the war came and everything stopped. And so naturally the ambition was thus transferred into the daughter, which could have worked out badly, of course, but didn't. I'm eternally grateful to my mother for making me practice. I was a pretty willing participant, let's put it that way.
Was she the Polish half of the equation? Or?
Funnily enough, no. I mean, one always imagines that the Polish half would have been the sort of music half. Mm. But no, my father, although he loved music, was an engineer.
How amazing.
My mother was completely sort of English, Irish, Scottish, Canadian, with a hefty dose of Cree Indian blood as well. So I'm quite a mixture.
And that would make her, you know,
that would make her a
person.
Warrior.
Yes, yes.
Yes. But I enjoyed it, and I liked to please my mother, and I liked playing the piano very much, even from an early age. I didn't quite understand anything about it, but I was playing dutifully.
And who were you listening to at that time? Was there music in the household? I mean, were there pianists that you regularly listened to and thought, I can hear some magic here. This is what I would like to emulate.
Funnily enough, that happened rather late. Of course, my parents took us to concerts, but not when I was very young. And we lived out in the country. But then, at 9, I went to this music school. I started studying with Yvonne Hubert. And that was when my parents started taking me more often to concerts. And it was at age 12 that, coincidentally, it was a Rubinstein concert. And I sat in that audience and the light went on in my head. First of all, Rubinstein played so beautifully that night, maybe even more beautifully than usual, I don't know, but for me, it was the first time I'd heard him. I was moved to tears. I even wrote in my little diary that night, which I kept, "Now I understand. Now I understand what it's about to be a musician." And from that night on, I knew that I had to be a musician, but not only to be a musician, but to be associated with Chopin for the rest of my life.
Coincidentally, your career was effectively launched when you entered and won the inaugural Arthur Rubinstein competition in Israel, 1974, wasn't it?
I have to interject there, otherwise my friend Emmanuel Axe will be quite irritated, because Emmanuel won.
Oh!
Emmanuel won very, very deservedly. Anyway, what happened for me, though, was that Emmanuel got the prize, but I got the attention of Rubinstein. He said, "I love your playing." And that was enough for me. But he said, "What's your career like?" I said, "I don't have a career." And he looked completely perplexed. And then he said, "Right, well, I'll take care of you." And he did.
Your Polish heritage, I mean, that half of the family, and also the Rubinstein connection, made it inevitable that you had a preordained feeling for Chopin. I mean, it had to be that way. What makes Chopin special for you, and what for you is the key to unlocking the magic?
Yes, well, I'll backtrack here. Of course, anyone who has a drop of Polish blood, anyone in the world, has to have an affinity for Chopin. Because Chopin, to a Pole, you know, however fraction of a Pole I am, is much more than just a wonderful composer. He binds us together. You know, there are few things that kept the Polish nation together, and Chopin was one of them. That's one. But the other thing is that I think no composer, and I honestly believe this, understood the keyboard as well as Chopin. The other thing is, which is very weird, is that my hands are sort of identical to Chopin's hands physically. I've seen the plaster casts, and it's kind of eerie. Even to my double-jointed thumbs and my second finger that goes slightly to the right. So I've always felt very comfortable playing his music. It's comfortably written, of course, because he understands the instrument, but it's as if it's modeled for my hands. Now, what I do with it is something else, but I have that slight, I think, advantage. Then lastly, of course, I think that Chopin's music, on every level, appeals to so many people, because the endless melodies that are gorgeous, that are perfect, I mean, every single one of them, there's not, it, like in Mozart, for example, there's not a note put imperfectly. When you have the technical passages, so-called technical passages, you only have to slow them down, and they're all melodies. And so if you think of Chopin as just being sung the whole time, what a wonderful thing.
But in terms of singing, of phrasing and rubato and expression, I imagine it's quite easy to overcook this music.
This has been the problem all along, and this is why sometimes Chopin has had a bad rap, because people have considered him rather the dessert composer as opposed to the main course. But if one delves a little bit more, one finds the harmonics, the counterpoint, the love of Bach and Mozart shine through, and the influence thereby, the incredibly new structures that he puts in. This is not only serious music, this is profoundly revolutionary music and fascinating, which is why, although I'm drowning in Chopin this year, I'm never bored.
Just refer for a moment to this extraordinary melodic gift, which has always haunted me, and it's enshrined in that E major etude, which you play with such a shy intimacy, and I mean that is just achingly beautiful, that melody.
Yes, it is. It's wonderful. Obviously, there are things about my playing that I just can't help, that I do. But I also think that Chopin was very, very explicitly told his pupils and wrote that sentimentality should play absolutely no part in his playing, and that he really wanted us just to play the notes and follow his indications. Of course, if you do, you can't just do that if you have any kind of personality. But I think rubatos... the Chopin rubato, for example, is very clearly defined when Liszt says that it's like a tree trunk which stays steady and only the branches move, which means...
That's a beautiful image.
It is a beautiful image, and which really means that the accompaniment of the melody should try and remain as steady as possible, and the melody then can take a few liberties. But I think that Chopin, the reluctant romantic, who abhorred the excesses of a Schumann, never gave Schumann pieces for his pupils, did not like Heart on the Sleeve, was a very shy, reserved man, didn't show his feelings. I think this is all in his music. The fact that he had so much passion inside him will come through.
We're talking about infinitesimal sometimes.
Yes.
Elements of timing, but also an inner light, as you said, which is harder to explain.
Yes, and the inner genius. Which is then, that is our job. Our job is to try and find a way to project what was inside Chopin in a way that he hopefully would appreciate and share it all with the audience.
One of my other favourite pieces, which is a great example of his rapturous harmonic invention, is the Barcarolle in F-sharp.
Absolutely.
I mean, that is just...
I think that the coda of the Barcarolle is one of the greatest things, if not the greatest thing ever written for the piano. I think I even remember reading somewhere that Wagner was unbelievably impressed with that. Wagner, of course, got lost interest later because Liszt was such a Chopin fan, and I think Wagner got quite jealous. But there's something about that coda that I find it almost hard to play. It's hard to sit down and perform because it's so beautiful. And all that counterpoint in there. I mean, there's a reason why you like Bach so much.
Yes, it really, when you're listening to it, I mean, all those, the intricacies, the harmonic intricacies really just tug at you in
absolutely
extraordinary ways. 2002, Janina, you were diagnosed with a cancerous tumour in the muscle of your left arm. I mean, how cruel is that for a pianist? How did it manifest itself, first of all? I mean, what happened that made you suddenly aware of it? Just you lost...
No, nothing like that. I was was swimming in a pool in December in the Bavarian Alps. I'd gone there with my husband, my new husband at the time, just married. And we were taking a few days off because we were exhausted from touring. And I just recorded the 12 Transcendental Etudes of Liszt. So to see my left arm swollen, I really put it all down to the Liszt. I was quite lighthearted about it all because I'd never heard of anyone getting cancer in the arm. And I thought the chances that a concert pianist should get cancer in the arm is so ludicrous. And so, yes. You know, that I honestly didn't believe it. So even when the MRI came back and showed me the pictures and this huge thing was there, I still thought, oh, well, that's nothing. It's, you know. Of course, that all changed. 3 days later, had the biopsy and was lying in the hospital, and the doctor came to me and said, well, it's cancerous and has to come out. And my first remark was, will I be able to play the piano? And she said, well, we'll have to see. There will be some muscle damage. So then started 5 weeks of everyday radiation. And I have to say that at first that was rather fun. I mean, I know that sounds sick, but it really was rather fun because my husband, after a while, gave up everything in Germany to be with me. We'd never been together before, you know, so much. We had a wonderful time. When I was still feeling well at the beginning, we enjoyed New York, and I'd never had enough time to enjoy. So I saw friends. We went to operas. We went to art galleries. We had fun. You know, and everyone was sort of looking at me and saying, oh, isn't this terrible? And I said, well, you know, trying to pretend that it was terrible, but actually having fun. And then it stopped being fun, of course, because then after about 3 weeks, you start getting very tired. And then came the operation, of course, and then it hit me. I was ignoring the implications of all of this.
I was going to say, at what point did you start this idea that you might never transcribe the the left-hand concertos for the right hand? I mean, that's such a crazy idea in a sense, but I mean, I suppose conceivable.
I had woken up, of course. I felt that my fingers were working just fine, which was wonderful, but there was nothing in my arm. My arm could do nothing. It just hung there, doing nothing. I got home from the hospital, and the next day, I pulled out the Ravel concerto. And I'd always wanted to learn, and I thought I think it's a fabulous piece. And I was very grateful I hadn't learned it, so I wasn't confused. I looked at it as a one-handed concerto. Mm-hmm. And I played through it, and I said, well, of course I can do this. I just have to jump around and play some of the little finger notes with my thumb and jump around. And, yeah. And some of it, of course, is much easier with the right hand. So, and then emboldened by that, and emboldened by the fact that so many orchestras where I'd been scheduled to play in North America, you see, unfortunately, most of my concerts that year were going to be the Liszt thing, recitals. But most of the orchestras said, well, sure, you need, if you can't play Brahms or Liszt or Chopin, then why not play Ravel left hand for the right hand? They're all very accommodating. So then I went crazy and I bought that there were Benjamin Britten and Richard Strauss and all these pieces for one hand. Yeah. And so I in these 2 years of not playing with two hands, I had maybe 12 concerts. So I wasn't quite completely out of it playing these one-handed concertos.
And then this extraordinary surgery which transplanted muscle.
From my back.
Just extraordinary.
I still find it very hard to believe. So within 6 months, January 2003, the operation took place. In fact, and he unhooked the latissimus muscle in my back, which is only used for Olympic gymnasts, really. It's a poor little muscle that was having a nice nap for my entire life. And I was forced into this occupation of taking the job of three muscles.
Yeah.
And playing this horrible noise all the time. So
all those polonaises.
Oh, this poor little thing, you know. And probably doesn't even like Chopin, you know. Probably likes pop music. But anyway, no.
What interests me, of course, is that your resolve of coming through this and building again must have changed your playing. I mean, has it changed, do you think? Is there another dimension?
I'm told there is. And I think all I can say is that there's probably less... I'll say it sounds a little strange, but there's less ambition in my playing. less ambition to be the woman pianist who can do everything. I don't care anymore about that. I think there is an element of serenity in my playing that was not there before.
In your London Chopin recitals,
yes.
Which I gather are in aid of cancer research, mm-hmm, aren't mm-hmm. they? And you're giving us the third sonata in B minor at the end.
Yes, I am.
You were talking about all those elements of inner peace and calm mm-hmm. and depth, and mm-hmm. and that slow movement of that concerto mm-hmm. is something else, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes, it is.
How have you found that has changed?
Well, the night before I had my surgery, well, the day before, I sat at the piano for about 4 hours, and the last piece I played was that movement. And then I closed the piano. That was the moment when I thought I might never play again. So that's how much this means to me. And then it was the first piece I played in concert after. It was in my comeback concert. And it was very emotional for me to play it, but also extraordinarily difficult for me to play it. Now, the doctors have said that my muscle development would plateau after 2 years. What makes me very happy is that now, technically, the B minor sonata is fine. It is my muscles developed so much that I'm much easier playing it. I mean, it's a terribly difficult piece to begin with, but I'm having much less difficulty than back in 2004.
That's interesting.
Yes. It's just a piece that I love so much, and even if I hadn't had all of this cancer thing, and that it would have developed. You know, the thing is, that's the wonder of being a pianist, being a musician, is that it develops every day. One always hopes it develops in a new and wonderful way, whether you can't say better or worse, but technically speaking, it is better than it was 4 years ago.
So who are the composers? I mean, Chopin, Mozart, Liszt, who are the composers that you feel comfortable exploring now and want to explore now? Are there others that
haven't
mentioned?
Yes, there's the new composer in my life, Schubert. Schubert was the composer that I always held up as the one that I would work on when I was wise and mature and had lived and had experienced all the other composers. And this would then enable me to be able to pull off those sonatas with the repeats and that are fun for the pianist, but not always fun for the audience listening, except if it's a very specific Schubert audience. Anyway, after all this cancer thing, my husband, who shares Schubert's birthday a few hundred years later, said, now's the time. And it's his favorite composer. And I said, well, okay, yeah, maybe. Maybe I'm not wiser, but I'm certainly have lived. So, yes, Schubert is a composer that I've now discovered. I have had to shed a few composers, but it's okay, because people like Rachmaninoff, I only played his music because I was asked to play his music or because my last teacher was very much in the Russian school, so I learned Rachmaninoff to please him, but I never really was a Rachmaninoff person. I loved playing the Brahms concertos in the old days. I still love the Brahms concertos, but Brahms concertos are 40 minutes long, over 40 minutes long. Mm. If I had to practice them, then I couldn't practice anything else.
Yeah.
So I've sort of very reluctantly
It may have helped taking them out of the equation in a way, because you can focus.
Exactly, and I really honestly don't think that I would play them as well now, because of all the left-hand work in the bottom of the keyboard. And there's a lot of Liszt that I've had to take out of my repertoire. But luckily, Liszt has written so much music that I do find things that are absolutely no problem for my left arm. But the fact is that I can't reach about the lowest octave in the piano and have to lean over it to my body to be able to play those notes. And if there's a lot of activity down there, then it's quite painful.
Janina, as if all this wasn't enough, you also fell foul to an extraordinary scandal which rocked the music world, the Joyce Hatto scandal. No. For the benefit of those who don't know about it, this lady pianist's husband plundered other pianists' work and claimed it as her own. No one's ever spoken to the people whose work was stolen.
Yes.
I mean, does it feel like being violated? I mean, how did it feel when you... I mean, were you just amused, or was there a deeper response?
No, I was actually never amused by it. I just felt it was disgusting. I immediately had this mental picture of these two people in a room sort of taking my CD and other people's CDs and chopping them up a little bit and putting them together and sort of deciding, shall we use this one or shall we use this one? And it's rather a disgusting picture. You know, I only found out much later. I didn't know it was going on, actually. It was one of the Hatto detectives that, you know, was trying to find out who had recorded what. And they had been for a long time trying to find out who had done the Mephisto waltz. And there was a huge article in the New Yorker all about it as well. And they sent me that article, but then this computer geek said it was your Mephisto waltz. That was the first I heard about it. But I had then found out that, you know, my friends Fema Bronfman and Eugene Injik and a lot of Ashkenazi even. I mean, he used everybody. And I sort of, at the back of my mind, thought, well, I might have felt a bit left out of it.
Yes.
If he hadn't used. But no, amused, no.
Janina, to close, I suppose, if you had to choose, I mean, this is a silly question, really, but if you had to choose one piece of Chopin, and as your sort of most special piece of Chopin, what would it be?
I think it would be the B minor sonata. It would be either the B minor sonata or the Barcarolle, but probably the B minor sonata, which has everything in it. Everything that I could ever ask from a piece of music is there. Mm. And I love this piece.